You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 19th of April 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, broadcasting live from Studio One here in London. I'm Emma Nelson. Ahead in the next 60 minutes, it's more than coups, wars, disease and Mugabe. The director of the Royal African Society accuses the press of failing to report the continent accurately. 65 years of seeing things differently, we celebrate the anniversary of the legendary photo agency Magnum. And as Sony moves one step further towards hoovering up EMI, we assess the impact of such a monolithic deal. All that, plus a song or two, and a check-in with our own Hugo MacDonald live from Milan. That's here on Midori House on Monocle 24. First of all, though, let's get the latest news from around the world with James Luckhurst.
Monocle 24 News. The Syrian Foreign Ministry has said it has signed an agreement with the United Nations on the terms of a ceasefire monitoring mission. A statement from UN Arab League mediator Kofi Annan said the Syrian government and the United Nations had agreed a basis for a protocol on the deployment of more observers. However, the United Nations Secretary-General Ban Ki-moon has said the situation in Syria remains highly precarious. Mr. Ban said he'd seen deeply troubling evidence of continuing violence despite the nominal ceasefire. He stressed Syria's responsibility to provide unfettered access and use of helicopters to the team. Prosecutors at the trial of Anders Behring Breivik have been cross-examining him about the bomb he set off outside a government building in Oslo last July. He says he used computer games to research scenarios for the explosion, which killed 8 people and injured 209 others. After the explosion, he went to Utøya Island, where he shot dead 69 more people. Observers at the trial were speculating as to whether playing extreme computer games could have turned Breivik into a killer. Pal Grøndahl, a forensic psychologist, said the activity could affect different people in different ways.
Some persons will have trouble with separating reality from fantasy, while other persons will have no trouble even after extended periods of much computer games. So some would actually need treatment after that, and some doesn't need that at all.
The International Monetary Fund Managing Director Christine Lagarde has said there's a light economic worldwide recovery underway, but that it's threatened by dark clouds on the horizon. Speaking at a press conference, Mrs. Lagarde said there was room for some short-term optimism, but that there were other factors that were giving cause for concern. She urged European governments to implement necessary reforms.
If we had a message to Europe, and the Eurozone in particular, it would be keep up. Keep up for better and more Europe. Keep up means implement the reforms that have taken place nationally, at the regional level, within the currency zone. Keep up in deepening the integration of the zone at multiple levels.
India's Prime Minister has hailed the launch of a home-developed intercontinental ballistic missile. The Agni 5 missile, which was launched this morning, has a range of 5,000 kilometres, which means it could reach targets in China or Eastern Europe. Manmohan Singh said the launch was a tribute to the sophistication and commitment to national causes of India's scientific and technological community. The European Parliament has passed a controversial bill that would allow the US Department of Homeland Security to have access to personal information about airline passengers. The information will include details about names, addresses, telephone and credit card numbers. Supporters of the bill say it's vital, a vital part of the fight against terrorism, but opponents are concerned about civil rights implications over how the information would be used. It was passed by 409 votes to 226. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much indeed, James. The time is 4 minutes past the hour and you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
And a Monocle 24 highlight, yeah.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 e Yorkosa.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The Propojalava.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And we begin today's programme with our daily update on the countdown to the first round of France's presidential elections on Sunday. To give us the latest commentary, joining us as ever on the line from Paris is the legendary journalist Christine Ocrente. A very warm welcome back to Midori House, Christine. Today we're talking about the markets, and there's reports that the markets are being suspicious of a victory either for Sarkozy or Hollande.
Yes, indeed, which shows that the markets are suspicious by nature, and they have no political affiliation. I think they react, as always, depending on what they view as the reform capacity. I was just listening to Christine Lagarde, you were broadcasting a few minutes ago. I think that it's obvious that France needs to conduct structural reforms, like many European countries, including Great Britain, by the way. And of course, whether it's Hollande or Sarkozy, such reforms will have to be made. So the markets have been quite jittery for some time now. It's interesting to see that each main candidate, Hollande as well as Sarkozy, are, of course, very wary of the markets. Sarkozy keeps saying that if Hollande is elected, there will be a terrible backlash. And Hollande answers back by saying that it's really not proper to try and frighten the French. So that's about the level of discussion about that issue. But it's obvious that it will be a dimension of the post-second round situation.
You mentioned that what Christine Lagarde was saying, and she was basically encouraging every single country to implement reforms at a regional level and to continue further and further into integration into the EU. Hollande, in terms of reforms, Hollande plans to balance the books by 2017. Sarkozy is targeting 2016, but the markets are saying that neither plan is a possibility or realistic.
Well, it all depends, of course, on growth. And, you know, each government talks about growth as if they had a magic wand. The problem throughout Europe is how to restore growth when at the same time Germany has been imposing a very strict fiscal policy, which entails high risks of deflation. So there's that spiral, you know, of imposing more austerity, which of course is needed, but that in turn means that there are, you know, less jobs, less taxes, and so on and so forth. So without going into too much of a technical discussion, it's obvious that our countries are going through a difficult economic cycle. And that in France in particular, once the elections are over, whoever is in charge will have a rough time facing reality.
And including in that reality is obviously the relationship with Germany, which you just mentioned there. The French media are saying that Berlin's preparing itself for an Hollande victory, and that although Angela Merkel has publicly backed Sarkozy, and as she would do, having worked so closely with him on the fiscal pact last year, there have been discreet, unofficial meetings between part of Hollande's camp and the Konrad Adenauer Foundation, which is connected to Merkel.
Yes, indeed. There are all sorts of contacts going on currently through think tanks, of course, but also at technical levels in governments, and particularly Berlin, but also Vienna and Rome and a few others. It's obvious that the more Hollande's victory becomes obvious, the more his people are working very hard to make as smooth a transition as possible after the second round. This being said, as far as Madame Merkel is concerned, she will have to face whoever is in that office in the Élysée, and it has been the case, you know, with Franco-German relations. for the past 50 years. And it has little to do, by the way, with political affiliation. It has more to do with personal chemistry between the leaders. And I think that's true today all over Europe.
When we're talking about the relationship between France and possibly the rest of the Europe, when we look at the monetary ideas, when you've seen Sarkozy nail down the fiscal pact with Merkel last year, and then suddenly François Hollande says that he will reassess the fiscal pact if it isn't going to provide extra growth for France, is Hollande actually making a realistic pledge there, or is this just posturing to try to sort of attract a certain part of France?
I think there's, of course, a bit of posturing, which is what campaigning is mostly about. But there's also a reality. You know that Mario Monti, the Italian leader, together with 10 others, has signed a letter saying that austerity is one thing, but we all need growth. Of course, his recipes are very different from what Hollande pretends his own would be. But I think throughout Europe, there's great concern about the need to restart the economic machine, create jobs, and give hope to people, and particularly to young people. When it comes to the pact, you know, something very similar happened way back with the Maastricht Treaty, when Jospin, the socialist prime minister then, asked for the treaty to be complemented with a new chapter about growth. So everybody agreed, a new chapter was added. Frankly, it didn't change much to the real evolution of things, but it was a sort of formal concession to the French at the time. So it may well be that, next June or July, European partners might agree to add a few lines to the fiscal compact saying, oh, by the way, we also need growth.
When we turn now to the policies of Sarkozy and Hollande, who are likely to be the two contenders in the second round of the presidential elections, both have been very strict in terms of what they're going to do to corporations, and effectively they've both put forward a tax the rich policy, haven't they? Hollande especially saying that he'll put a 75% tax on revenues of more than €1 million per year.
Yes, indeed. That was, Hollande and Sarkozy have been announcing a lot of measures, and most of them have gone absolutely unnoticed. They haven't printed into people's minds, except for one, as far as Hollande is concerned, which is indeed the one you mentioned, the 75% tax for the very rich or the very high income. That was a concession he made at the time to try and stop the ascension in the polls of Mélenchon, who is the extreme left candidate. So that announcement was not enough. Mélenchon kept rising in the polls. But of course, Hollande is also, saying, oh, I'm not the candidate of the rich, as opposed to Sarkozy, whose very best friends are all business tycoons and so on and so forth. Now, Sarkozy's campaign has also been, anti-elites and anti-rich and, I'm close to the people and so on and so forth. So on both sides, it's a sort of populist positioning, which I'm not sure many people are convinced about.
It's not necessarily just a specific positioning either, is it, Christine? Because everybody seems to have jumped on this particular bandwagon. Like you say, Sarkozy has withdrawn from his image as Monsieur Bling Bling, and is getting a bit more, playing his image as a man of the people. Mélenchon, an open hatred of Wall Street, as you say. And then these posters on the walls of Paris for the almost invisible candidate Jacques Cheminade saying, "Un monde sans City ni Wall Street." No, a world without the city and without Wall Street. Everybody seems to be jumping on this bandwagon. What's been the reaction in France to everyone saying the same thing?
Well, I think that on the whole, people are anxious about the economic crisis. Unemployment is high. There has been, indeed, indignation about these rather obscene bonuses and salaries, which people have heard about, you know, since the financial crisis. But again, there's a lot of posturing and also some concern in the business community that indeed top management people would get discouraged, even if there are still a lot of investments in France, if you can't attract highly paid managers, because they would, you know, they would see 75% of their income going to taxes, that could raise some difficulties. But I think that all around there is concern about trying to get, to slow down that extraordinary gap, growing gap between the very rich and the middle class. And I think that's true in Britain as well.
I was reading somewhere, there's an article by a French philosopher who teaches at Stanford called Jean-Pierre Dupuy, and he said that he's ashamed to see that in France, politics lets itself be humiliated by the economy. What do you think he meant by that?
Well, Jean-Pierre Dupuy is a philosopher, so...
But we were speaking, it takes
at least 6 pages of dissertation to answer his point. I think, the economy is a fact of life. Now, it's true that economists tend to be wrong all the time, but it's not the perfect science. But again, we're in a globalized world, and indeed, these issues matter a great deal.
Christine, thank you very much indeed for joining us, and I'll leave you to compile your dissertation on the response to Monsieur Dupuy's line. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. That was Christine Ocant on the line. We'll be talking to Christine again tomorrow for the last in our updates of our week-long coverage of the race for the Élysée Palace. It's coming up to 17 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, and in a moment we'll be hearing some music from Lana Del Rey, so stay with us.
This week on The Urbanist, we're looking at how, with the use of statues and monuments, cities commemorate key events in their histories and also their dead yet celebrated residents. We start by talking to Peter Eisenman, the American architect who designed Berlin's controversial yet now loved memorial to the murdered Jews of Europe. Next, it's to Richmond, Virginia, to visit Monument Avenue, which reveals much about the city's colourful Confederate past. Then we find out about a statue of Lenin that ended up in New York City. And in London, we find out about an artsy monument project in Trafalgar Square. Plus, there's our tour stories, news, and of course, this week's Urbanist song.
That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24. It started with a shop in London's Marylebone, and now Monocle also has stores in New York, Tokyo, Hong Kong, and a shop in Osaka. And then there's the Monocle Cafe in Tokyo. Come in to find exclusive collaborations with brands we believe in, from Barena jackets to Porter luggage. Great for gifts, even better for personal treats. And if you're missing an issue from your Monocle archive, we can soon fix that. Visit monocle.com for store addresses and opening times. The Monocle Shop, carefully crafted design, proud of its provenance.
Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson. In a moment, we'll be talking about an accusation that press coverage of Africa is simply wrong. Before that, let's get some music, though. This is Lana Del Rey and Summertime Sadness.
Kiss me hard before you go. Summertime sadness. I just wanted you to know the baby.
That was Lana Del Rey on Monocle 24 and Summertime Sadness. You're listening to Midori House. Africa is a place full of coups, wars, disease, hunger and Mugabe. That, according to my next guest, are possibly one of the few subjects the European media take notice of. In an open letter on the Royal Africa Society's website, Richard Dowden accuses the British media of failing to dig deep enough when it comes to covering the continent. I'm very pleased to say that Richard joins me in the studio today. Richard, am I accurate in your accusation?
Yes, I think you are. And I would have to admit that I've been, in a way, been part of that, because I've been a journalist covering Africa really, I think, exclusively since the early 80s. I know exactly, you know, what the problem is. I think I do anyway.
So tell us what brought you to this point where you felt that you had to speak out about the coverage.
Because for the last 10 years, Africa has been growing, its economies have been growing very fast. And it's also become much more democratic. The elections aren't always great, but there's a huge amount of knowledge now in Africa about what's going on, whereas before people were limited to what the government told them. And so there is a huge ferment going on in Africa at the moment, which is very, very positive. Yet still, what we're used to is, oh, starving Africa or violent Africa or Mugabe, or, you know, and it's all terrible. It's all tribalism, corruption and these sort of things. And it isn't. It's changing very, very fast. And if we don't keep up with it, we're just going to lose it completely.
Now, your criticism was directed directly at the BBC and then at the broader media in general, all of whom come from what you said that, what was it that you write in your article, you can't come here with European eyes. Arguably, if you do come from the West or from Europe, that is the only way with which you are going to see a continent, regardless as whether it's Africa or any other.
That's true, but that's why you need in these countries people who really understand them. And Africa is one of the most diverse continents on the, I think it is the most diverse continent on the planet, actually. It's where we all come from, so that's quite natural that it should be. I think that the images have come from particular countries at particular times. In the 1990s, yes, Africa was getting poorer, and there were 26 wars in that decade, some of them incredibly violent. I mean, the one in Congo is said to have caused the deaths of 5 million people. It got almost no coverage. So there's an irony there that actually it was really bad and perhaps we didn't cover it well enough. But what I'm trying to say is there should be a much deeper understanding of Africa on the one hand. So what's the causes of these? You know, what are the underlying causes here? And secondly, there is another Africa developing which gets tarred with this brush of being violent and poor and starving. A country like Botswana, it's never had a war. It's had democratic governments, several changes of governments, and everybody ignores it. You can say that news, by its definition, is bad news, and no news editor is going to send me to go and sit in the capital of Botswana, Gaborone, and say, oh, there's another nice, quiet, successful day in this pretty little country.
Well, that's exactly what was said when we looked at this article a few moments ago in our newsroom and said, well, surely the nature of the news is that it is unusual. And if you were to look at a newspaper on any given day of the week, it is going to portray a picture of a world which is not 100% accurate. In fact, it only shows the unusual elements. How do you answer that?
I think the difference is that we don't have any other images of Africa in our heads. When New Orleans was underwater, we didn't think the whole of America was underwater. But that's what this portrayal, this continual coverage of wars and famines and disasters in Africa has resulted in. We don't have any other images of Africa in our heads.
So you're asking us to take a fundamentally different approach to covering Africa. How do you suggest we go about doing this?
Well, I think that the mission to explain the complexity of Africa is very important. So yes, go and bring the reality of the war. But what they tend to do next in the past is show a white aid worker saving an African baby. And that's the sort of image we want to get rid of. Most of 99% of Africans who survive war survive it because of their own efforts. So there's a mission to balance that. Secondly, a mission to explain the deeper causes and not just say, oh, it's poverty or whatever. No, there are deep political causes and that needs explaining. And then also to show, I mean, there are lots of rather good things happening in Africa. They have the most, I mean, one of the great ironies was that through the war that tore Somalia to pieces, the Somalis produced the most sophisticated telephone banking system on the planet. They were transferring large sums of money sent by Somalis outside into Somalia. It worked perfectly. And it was all done on mobile phones. And things like that, I think, are transforming the continent. And that's the sort of... It's an amazing story, but it doesn't often get told.
It is a very difficult balance to strike, though, as you say, with the need to tell a story. And I'll draw your attention to something like Kony 2012, which many people have condemned for its content because it is possibly imbalanced, very emotive. Nonetheless, it brought to the fore a very... definitely interesting and necessary story that needed to be told.
I made two films about Kony. I went up to northern Uganda, made two films, and they were shown, one on Channel 4 News and the other on the BBC. No impact whatever as that I could see.
So would you argue that by any means necessary in certain circumstances?
Well, I think in one way, you know, they've succeeded where I failed. But the fact was it was presented in such a way. And also it's 3 years out of date. I mean, Kony's no longer in Uganda. He's gone off further north. So, you know, it was totally... inaccurate in that way, but it certainly got people going.
Surely, if we change our approach, or if the Western world changes its approach to portraying Africa, no matter what it does, it will always be done through European eyes. So arguably, is it not the role of the European media, but actually Africa itself, to take control and get these stories out and tell people what it's really like?
I think this is true. I think Africa's got to has got to tell its own story better. But when you meet Chinese and Indians and Brazilians in Africa, they're not particularly worried about this at all. And what I'm afraid of is that Europe, in its sort of fear of Africa and its... it doesn't go there anymore, and that Africa and the links, the very important links between Europe and Africa are broken because the only news we ever heard of you was bad news, whereas there's a lot of very good things happening which would help maintain those links.
Richard Dowden, thank you very much indeed for joining us in the studio. That was Richard Dowden here. The time is 29 minutes to the top of the hour. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
Добро пожаловать, Monocle 24.
Du lytter til Monocle 24.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 no gigan des.
Du lyssnar på Monocle 24.
Você está escutando Monocle 24.
Sie hören Monocle 24.
Akute Monocle 24.
Kuuntelet Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House. In the next half hour, we'll see what our very own Hugo McDonald has been up to at the Salone del Mobile in Milan. The photographer Peter Marlowe will join us in the studio to talk about the legacy of the legendary Magnum Photos, which is celebrating its 65th anniversary, and big changes in the music industry ahead as Sony prepares to acquire EMI. Before all that, here's James Luckhurst with the latest news headlines.
The Syrian Foreign Ministry has said it has signed an agreement with the United Nations on the terms of a ceasefire monitoring mission. A statement from UN Arab League mediator Kofi Annan said the Syrian government and the United Nations had agreed a basis for a protocol on the deployment of more observers. Prosecutors at the trial of Anders Behring Breivik have been cross-examining him about the bomb he set off outside a government building in Oslo last July. He says he used computer games to research scenarios for the explosion, which killed 8 people and injured 209 others. After the explosion, he went to Utøya Island, where he shot dead 69 more people. The International Monetary Fund Managing Director Christine Lagarde has said there's a light economic worldwide recovery underway, but that it's threatened by dark clouds on the horizon. Speaking at a press conference, Mrs. Lagarde said there was room for some short-term optimism, but there were other factors that were giving cause for concern. India's Prime Minister has hailed the launch of a home-developed intercontinental ballistic missile. The Agni 5 missile, which was launched this morning, has a range of 5,000 kilometres, which means it could reach targets in China or Eastern Europe. And the European Parliament has passed a controversial bill that would allow the US Department of Homeland Security to have access to personal information about airline passengers. The information will include details about names, addresses, telephone and credit card numbers. Those are the headlines here at Monocle 24.
We'll be right back. Thank you very much, James. And James will be back at the top of the hour with a full roundup of the world headlines. Now, we've been broadcasting live from Milan for the second hour of The Globalist on Monocle 24 every day this week, with Monocle's design editor Hugo MacDonald at the helm, bringing us all the highlights from the Salone del Mobile Furniture Fair, reporting on the newest trends and talking to world leaders in design. Well, he's taken a break from doing all that, and he's joining us on the line for yet another update. A very warm welcome to Midori House, Hugo. How are you this afternoon?
I'm very well, thank you. It's been quite a wearying week, but very inspiring too.
I was about to say, you must have terribly sore legs, because every time we mention the Salone del Mobile, it is the size which you always refer to.
Oh, I know, and it's bigger than ever, which is hard to believe, because each year you think, surely it can't grow, but there's new areas that have opened this year and new different places. What's so lovely about it, actually, is that Milan is traditionally a very closed city, and people always refer to Fashion Week as saying that it's something that happens behind the velvet rope. It's definitely not a public affair. But Salone is completely the opposite. Everyone throws open their doors and gates, and exhibitions happen all over the city and sort of palazzos that remain closed for the rest of the year. And it's a wonderful sort of celebration of not just design, but also of Milan, the city, too.
Now, before you went out, you were slightly fearful that what was a brilliant fair had become slightly flabby in its 51st year. Yet just before you got on the plane, you were mentioning that actually you were getting the slightest inkling that people were really getting to grips with what the Salone should be all about. Has that happened?
Well, it has actually. It's quite interesting. The fair itself, and they haven't released any official figures, but it seems much skinnier and much better for it, actually. In the past, the big manufacturers would take over thousands and thousands of square feet for all their products that they would be launching. This year, their stands are much, much smaller. The exhibitions, instead of throwing money at decorating these different stands, have been spent investing, presumably, in R&D and making sure that actually they're launching fewer but higher quality, much more interesting, much more necessary products. Which is sort of good news, because it means that you don't have to rake through acres of sort of slightly lacklustre things to get to the nice, interesting product. And it's actually everybody sort of trying to put their best foot gently forward.
Have they given any reason why?
Have they what? Sorry?
Have they given any reason why they've gone all skinny this year?
They've been saying that, you know, they're having to refocus, and people have been quite honest in saying, you know, the funds simply aren't there to launch 15 products, so they've decided to dip back into their archive, launch maybe three or four products, and bring back two products that have gone out of production from the past, and bring them back because they feel that they're relevant nowadays. But also, it's sort of a general consensus that there is just too much stuff, and we really need to have this enormous catalogue of furniture being forever growing year on year.
Now,
is something that we've talked about in the past, and it's very true. I mean, you don't need to have 1,000 new chairs launched each year. There's just no need for it.
Now, when the Salone made its first appearance in, 1961, it was promoting Italian furniture, furnishing accessories on the export market. And it's basically the showcase for Italian brands. Is that still the case this year?
It's still very much the case for the Italian brands. You know, it's their fair. But that said, it's completely global now. And the Italian brands have sort of taken their presence almost away from the fairgrounds just outside Milan, which is sort of the centre of the trade fair. And they all have showrooms in Milan, and they've decided this year to sort of really focus on presenting their new collections in the showrooms in the heart of the city rather than at the fair, and to leave the fair to the international crowd who come. Again, that's sort of something that makes the fair seem a little bit more small. And manageable, but also the Italian manufacturers have been quite unanimous in saying that for them, they want to present their new collections in an environment in which those collections make sense. There's no need for them to split their budget in two and do something in their showrooms in the city as well as at the fair. It's much better to concentrate on spending the money on doing a really fantastic exhibition or sort of bringing a new designer into their fold rather than just sort of throwing money at needless of decoration, which has definitely been the case in the past.
It's obviously also quite an intelligent way of using the city itself as the decoration and making the Salone spread out of the fair.
Exactly. And so the sort of a growing thing is that people don't really visit the fair. I mean, buyers and hard business is obviously still done there. But a lot of the sort of journalists and design enthusiasts and everybody who also descend on Milan for the Salone increasingly say, you know, there's not much need to even go to the fair itself because there's so much happening in the city. And if you come to Salone for the Italian brands, which so many people still do only really come to see that, then you can actually spend quite a pleasant week wandering around from showroom to showroom and exhibition to exhibition and still take away an enormous amount of the way that the furniture industry is going over the next year.
So as a result, Milan sounds quite interesting and quite full, I would imagine.
It is. It's heaving. There's not a hotel room in the city. In fact, the taxi driver I had yesterday was saying there really literally is no hotel room left in the city, and that the tourist board have been advising people to stay in Lodi, which is the town about an hour and a half away outside Milan. So it sort of gives some... it sort of shows you a little bit about the scale of the event. It's sort of like all the fashion weeks from all the different four main fashion cities combined into one city for one event for the whole year.
Hugo, thank you very much indeed. Do keep up the good work, and we'll be interested to hear your next report tomorrow from The Globalist, tomorrow morning at 0700 London time. You're listening to Midori House. The time is 20 minutes to the top of the hour. And in a moment, we'll be celebrating 65 years of Magnum.
Weekends on Monocle 24 are for relaxing, taking stock of the week's events, and keeping an eye on the week ahead. The Review is our hour-long Saturday show, looking back at the books, TV shows, films, and events that have made our week, as well as a regular magazine review. Monocle Weekly, our original audio offering, is where it all started. Tyler Brulé, Robert Bound, and Andrew Tuck discuss the week ahead with guests, analysis, and a good helping of music. Perfect Sunday listening. And if you need a short, concise summary of the week's highlights, look no further than The Curator, in association with Rolex, a one-hour roundup of all the juiciest bits of the past week on Monocle 24. So listen to The Review, Monocle Weekly, and The Curator for the full Monocle 24 weekend experience, either live on Monocle 24, on our timeshift player at monocle.com, or on iTunes.
Every Saturday on The Review, Monocle's editors ditch their jackets and unbutton their top buttons for a cosy weekend look at what's selling at bookshops from Buenos Aires to Brisbane.
This store was insanely busy. It was incredible. So if you had walked in on that day from outer space, you would never have had any clue that people weren't passionately in love with physical books.
A survey of the Global Newsstand. Some fine tracks chosen by a great music guest and lots of good conversation. Join us every Saturday at midday London time. And remember, this show is best enjoyed with coffee while camped out on your sofa.
Minutes at the top of the hour here on Monocle 24. You're listening to Midori House with me, Emma Nelson. 65 years ago, five of the world's best photographers founded Magnum. One of their aims was to be curious about the world and to transcribe it visually. The archives now include images from some of the key events of the last century, and to this day, the selection process for membership is rigorous. Well, one of those members is the award-winning photographer Peter Marlowe, and I'm delighted to say he joins me in the studio now. Peter, a very warm welcome to Midori House. Tell us about the... before we talk about Magnum today, tell us about how Magnum was brought together by the five photographers.
The five photographers in 1947, I guess it was as a kind of reaction to the control that magazines and newspapers had over photography, in that when you were assigned, you were actually handing over your copyright as well. So the five members decided that this had to end, and set up the agency which we know as Magnum, in order to fight that particular issue.
One of the founder members said that this was an idea too halcyon to be true.
Maybe. I mean, we're still going 65 years later, so we must have been doing something right. But you know, we're in a world where the photography industry is it's transformed itself. It's completely unrecognizable from how it was. And, it's not easy to keep going these days, but we're one of the few independent photo agencies left.
So the foundation of it, you describe it as almost an economic drive for it to be for Magnum to come together. Was there an aesthetic behind it as well, or a brief behind which every photographer must follow?
Oh, yes. I mean, everything has to have an economic element, I suppose. But there's a sort of, it started out as a pretty mad combination of a sort of conglomeration of a reporter and an artist. And so much about what Magnum is about photographers finding a way to express themselves in their own unique way. And it provided an opportunity where each of the members could really do what they wanted. And, you know, some people didn't even want to take paid jobs. They were that sort of committed to their own vision. And so, you know, it became whatever those individuals made it.
Now, it sounds incredibly rigorous in terms of the discipline once you are there, but I mentioned at the beginning of this piece that the selection process itself is very, very tough. You've been through it. What happens to you?
Well, it's quite an arcane thing, and I hesitate to sort of go into the whole mechanics of it, but basically the myth is that photographers are invited to join this group. The reality is that, you know, in my own case, I was working with a very hard-nosed French photo agency, and I was really having to jump whenever they said jump. And I had heard that people in Magnum could do what they wanted, so I was very attracted by that. And so I canvassed a few photographers, went along and showed them my work, and then was allowed into the submission process, because we get together once a year, all the photographers, and it alternates between London, Paris and New York. And we look at portfolios, but they're kind of pre-screened by the individual members, the people that I canvassed at the time. And it's always good to have a sort of champion. So the process, to cut the long story short, the process is that first portfolio, if you get a 50% vote of the members, which are now is about 50 of us, then you start a process where you become a nominee, and then 2 years later you have to present another portfolio, and you become a higher status, which is called an associate, and then between 2 and 5 years later you present another portfolio, but this time you need a two-thirds majority, and you become a full voting member who can have influence over the organisation.
And what is it that they are looking for when choosing new members?
That's quite a difficult question. I mean, I think, you know, what we're not looking for is, it's easier to say what we're not looking for is sort of clones of Cartier-Bresson or Bob Capa. I think we're looking for individuality and a voice and a sense of authorship and a sense of signature in the work. And the whole, what is, I think, so amazing about Magnum is that the process of joining the group actually makes you a better photographer and hopefully a better person as well. But you're forced to get to the bottom of what you're doing, and you can't just sort of wing it in a way.
In what way? Give me an example.
In my own case, I was working as a photojournalist quite successfully, I think. But the work I was doing was a bit generic. And so it sort of forced me into thinking, you know, how can I make this, how can somebody look at one of these pictures and say, right, that's by this photographer, that's by me? And so it's a long, long process. And I think that, it doesn't happen overnight. But the amazing thing is that I think with the right kind of help and tutoring and mentoring, I think anyone could do it. That's the, so the mythology is a bit, you know, it's not quite true, really.
The fact that it is still a cooperative owned by its members, do you think that has shaped Magnum's identity?
Very much so. It's made us quite it's made us quite a unique organisation. It's made us also quite an awkward organisation to deal with, because we, we're very reluctant to compromise. And so, you know, in today's world where you can do whatever you want with the photograph, you know, we just say no. I'm sorry, you can't. And you can create images. You don't actually have to be in a place. So we are very determined in sort of keeping alive the values of the founders, if you like. So that's, you know.
Moment ago, you mentioned that the world of photography has changed immeasurably. And you just said that, you know, that your ability to say no is what marks you out as being different from so many other photographers. Is it really that tough nowadays when we see things about everyone talking about citizen photographer, citizen journalist, even the idea of the Instagram making everything look the same? Are we really in a great deal of trouble here, or are the likes of Getty and Magnum actually going to maintain quality?
Well, I would hope so. I think there's, you know, the citizen photographers can take amazing pictures, but can they take them over and over again? Probably not. But it has meant that the sort of role of the reporter photographer, the photojournalist, whatever you want to call them, has changed radically, because you can never get to a story fast enough because somebody's always there. The nature of the business changed hugely.
So how do you go about making it different then? If you have someone there, if you have the freelancer who will take the photograph for you, what does the Magnum photographer do to make it different?
What do they bring to the table? Oh dear, I don't know. I think it's a mistake to think of the Magnum photographer. We're a group of individuals, you know. We're not, we're a sort of quite anarchic group in a way. I mean, what did de Gaulle say? How could you govern a country with 365 different types of cheese? You know, I hate to sort of generalize on what is a Magnum photographer, because I think we're all different.
Finally, you said that you were working for a very tough French agency that made you jump whenever they called you, and you left to join Magnum because you could do what you thought you could do what you want. Did you end up being able to do what you wanted?
You know, subject to certain constraints, as in, for instance, making a living. Yes, I think I did, yeah.
Peter Marlowe, thank you very much indeed for joining us. That's Peter Marlowe from Magnum Photos. You're listening to Midori House. It's 10 minutes towards the top of the hour.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Essa Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Ein Monocle 24 Tag, ja.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 Yorkshire.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The proper Jalavet. Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
After I met the Monocle 24.
The hat at Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24. You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Emma Nelson. Sony's been given the green light to take over EMI's music publishing business. It's a move which marks yet another step in the firm's bid to create the world's biggest song catalogue. The news broke around a couple of hours ago that the deal has now been approved by the European Competition Regulator. Well, to explain more and to assess the future, joining us now is Simon Dyson. He's the editor of Music and Copyright, a newsletter which covers global copyright and legal issues affecting the music industry. Welcome to Midori House, Simon. Just explain to us, who those not entirely up to date with the latest moves with the European regulators, what has happened today?
Well, in short, Sony and its consortium of companies have been given the go-ahead in Europe to acquire EMI Music Publishing. EMI won't be absorbed into Sony's publishing company. As part of the deal, it has to be kept as a separate company. But there's an awful lot of things which will now happen in the next year, 2 years, assuming it gets permission in the US and the other countries where regulators are looking at it.
This is the key, though, is that the United States, Australia and Brazil have still not actually given this the go-ahead.
It is. It's interesting that Europe and the European Commission is often seen as the most strict with regards to company mergers and market dominance and company dominance within a particular market. And it's interesting that they've agreed the deal at the first phase, even though it was extended a bit. I think a lot of people were surprised it didn't go into a more detailed second phase. But obviously, they were able to convince the European Commission that, you know, the planned sell-offs and all the things that they promised won't result in market dominance, and it won't sort of overly affect the market.
You mentioned planned sell-offs there. What is the price that Sony has had to pay for EMI?
Well, it's got to get rid of Virgin Music catalogues. I think originally the plan that they had, the European Commission didn't like. There's certain Anglo-American repertoire catalogues within Europe, and I think they had to extend it. I think they had to convince the Commission that, you know, they didn't want to produce a company that dominated the publishing industry, and so they've had to part with some big catalogues. But similar deals in the past, you know, you can part with catalogues, but once the deal's gone through, it doesn't stop you acquiring new catalogues in the future.
Sony will now have an enormous share, if this goes ahead, of the global publishing market, won't it? What will that look like?
It'll probably look like, if they didn't sell anything, if they didn't sell any of their catalogues, they would probably own, you know, they would control around about 30%. The figures that I've seen, the quick figures that have followed the European Commission statement suggest that they will have to reduce that to 25%, which isn't, that's not too dominant. You've got Universal Music in the recorded music sector, which has a bigger share than 25% of recorded music. So it's not sort of in the high 30s, which would concern a lot of people. But there are the critics, there are the independent sector is very critical of the deal, and you know quite what they will do. They've issued a statement saying they're not happy about it, but obviously they've got to study the full deal and then decide on what action to take.
It is the independent music labels, isn't it, who are shouting loudest alongside the likes of Warner Music against this. How would this merger actually affect independent music labels?
Well, the problem is, I mean, in any industry, if you've got one company that is very dominant, or one company that becomes more dominant, it control rates, it can have a bigger say in all sorts of things. Now, there's a lot happening within Europe at the moment, particularly with the European Commission, trying to open up the online music market in Europe. It's still licensing, publishing and licensing is still very fragmented. It's still, you know, to a certain degree, it's still based on at a national level. And services wanting to come in and wanting to launch a European-wide services have still got to negotiate licenses with a lot of collection societies and a lot of publishers. The European Commission are probably thinking, if we've got one company that can, you know, offer licenses for certain repertoire without having to go to all the national collection societies, that can possibly be a good thing. Obviously, the downside of that, you've got the repertoire, the local language repertoire that certain collection societies will issue licenses for, well, that comes pushed to the side. You know, the smaller independent record companies that, say, are based in Austria or Finland or something like that, their repertoire is not in heavy demand, and it'll probably be in less demand because Sony will be so dominant.
You say that the clearance by the European Union today has come as quite a surprise. Is that possibly due to the European Commission's review of Universal Music's attempts to buy EMI's recorded music division?
Yeah, I think it's probably an important point to make that the two deals are very, very different. The two industries, although they're all part of the music industry, you know, recorded music is very different to publishing. And I think people that involved in the Universal EMI deal, I think they recognised that it was going to go to a second phase. The market share is a lot higher than the Sony EMI market share, but I think there's been such scrutiny and concern over further consolidation within the music publishing industry. I mean, there's four major music publishers and four major record companies. Even though EMI is still going to exist as a separate publisher, all its administration is going to be taken over by Sony ATV. So effectively, you're almost going down to three publishers. And then if Universal gets the deal with EMI, you're going down to three record companies. So the independent sector's got a valid point, and you know, it expresses its concerns really well. But sadly, for as far as publishing is concerned, it doesn't seem to have worked.
And very briefly, because time is running out, can you see the US and Australia just giving this a go-ahead very soon?
I would imagine so. I think Europe seems to be the most strict. So if Europe have passed it, I can't see it not going through anywhere else.
Simon Dyson, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Midori House. That's all for this Thursday's edition. Today's show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernanda Augusta Pacheco. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. At 2200 hours London time, that's in 3 hours, Tom Burgess Watson and Andrew Muller will be back with the Monocle Daily. Up next after the news, you can join the latest episode of The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck. But from all of us on Midori House, goodbye. Thanks for listening.